Hello there. Today is Tuesday, January 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, nearly 200,000 Salvadorians are losing their immigration status in the U.S.
It will likely create thousands more undocumented immigrants for those who don't want to return to El Salvador.
Could a meeting on the Winter Olympics be a breakthrough for the Koreas? The Trump administration is opening up 90% of America's coastal waters to oil drilling. Also ahead, Hollywood's big awards season has officially begun. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is calling Tuesday's rare face-to-face talks between North and South Korea a big start, hoping they go beyond whether the North will be a part of next month's Winter Olympics. The U.S. has no part in Tuesday's talks, but is looking toward its close ally, South Korea, to possibly lead to some kind of dialogue with the North Korean regime.
I hope they do. I would love to see them take it beyond the Olympics. We have a very good relationship with South Korea. I would love to see it go far beyond the Olympics. Absolutely. And at the appropriate time, we'll get involved.
Representatives from both nations who are still officially at war are meeting formally in Panmunjom, the so-called peace village straddling the border where the 1953 armistice ending the fighting was signed. Tuesday's talks were expected to focus on the Olympics and whether athletes from the North and South can march jointly at the opening ceremonies next month. Other topics are likely to include resuming family reunions and a general improvement in relations. VOA's Ira Melman asks Michael Madden, visiting scholar at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University, if there is more to these talks than just the Olympics.
The Olympics are the primary focus of the agenda at the talks. To a certain degree, this is a matter of both the Koreas having to curtail any inter-Korea rapprochement ambition. But the Olympics are the main thing, and what they are focused on is getting North Korean athletes, in addition to the two figure skaters, to participate in the games, and also to see what senior officials from the DPRK are going to attend and how many cheerleaders are going to have. And so that's what they're focused on, and they might have some other sort of boilerplate stuff about further talks, but I think what they're choosing to focus on is getting the North Koreans to participate in the Olympics.
What is it about sports, especially the Olympics, that seems to, in many cases, open up international relations? We go all the way back to ping pong diplomacy with Richard Nixon in China, and there are a lot of other samples of this happening. What is it about sports and the Olympics?
I mean, it's the same as one would say for art, music, and culture. The people that are in, athletes and people in sports are not necessarily bound to the politics and the policy positions of their government. And it's sort of a unifying factor. I think one thing that gets kind of put in the background with the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games is that the Olympics were always intended to be sort of a non-political event. That, basically, it's sort of a peaceful event to reduce tensions throughout the world. And people can just go out and the athletes can go out and compete against each other. And, as we saw in 2016, maybe take a selfie with each other. I mean, there's a lot of politics that go into sports these days. But basically, the summum bonum, if you will, of the Olympic Games or international competitions is just sort of a love of sport and a love of competition.
Why do you think that Kim Jong-un has decided to say yes to this?
Well, partially he's saying yes to this because there is pretty widespread support in South Korea for some sort of engagement between the two Koreas, which is just it's a matter of tension reduction and a matter of reducing the chances of any sort of geostrategic miscalculation. The conversations that are going to happen in the peace village are actually the result of the two Koreas having off-the-record meetings in December. And so they're going to start with sports exchanges. And to a certain degree, this is President Moon Jae-in in South Korea serving Kim Jong-un's personal interest. Kim Jong-un is a big sports fan. And this is a creative way to approach the supreme leader of the DPRK.
What kind of a sign was it that the United States and South Korea both agreed to postpone or put back their military maneuvers?
I think that's a good faith gesture to Pyongyang. President Trump seems to exhibit a certain degree of flexibility and creativity in terms of the American position here. And we don't know the true nature of the conversations that he has with President Moon, but this is also, you know, arguably President Trump's aide and the National Security Council have sort of prevailed. This is a creative solution and, you know, can reduce a lot of the news headlines we saw last year, both in April and in August, of some sort of imminent nuclear war crisis on the peninsula.
Although that members of the president's cabinet and the U.S. administration, notably Nikki Haley and some others, have kept a hard line.
He has sort of kept a hard line, but she is sort of hinting that there is more creativity going on in the administration. It's one of the things that we're seeing here is a little more transparency in policy deliberations in the U.S. government at the senior level, which is to say that some cabinet officials have diverse and differing viewpoint. And that was the case under President Clinton. President Clinton used to have some of his cabinet folks, you know, argue over a certain policy issue, and he sort of used to form a compromised position. And rather than speaking with sort of one unified voice, there just seems to be a little more of a deliberation and debate. And I think that's necessary, especially for a very serious issue such as the Korean Peninsula.
That's Michael Madden, visiting scholar at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. More equipment and crews are heading to Puerto Rico for a power boost. How a Ugandan refugee became an American police shooting statistic. A new report warns IS is increasing its footprint in Pakistan. And a Madagascar cyclone has killed 29 people and displaced thousands. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. government says Monday it plans to suspend a protection extended to nearly 200,000 citizens of El Salvador who have lived in the United States for nearly two decades. Temporary protected status, which shielded hundreds of thousands of nationals from the Central American country from deportation following devastating earthquakes in 2001, will end September 9th, 2019. And on that day, those who have lived and worked illegally or legally in the United States for nearly two decades will revert to the immigration status they had before they received TPS, if it's still valid. Joining me now to discuss is Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, who specializes in immigration policy. So thanks for being with us, Justin. What will this decision actually mean?
It means different things for different people. I think that most acutely, the people who will feel the impact of this decision are the Salvadoran citizens. This decision means that they must effectively pick up and leave everything behind in the United States after previously doing the exact same thing in their country of origin, and they have about a year to do so. They have to leave behind family, they have to leave behind jobs, they have to leave behind, you know, other professional opportunities and, you know, friendships and relationships in their communities. You know, these are people who have been in the country a very long time. And anytime you spend over a decade in the same place, you're going to, you know, attach some roots. And effectively, this new policy means that people have to absolutely cut everything away and leave very suddenly.
What do you think is driving this decision?
The decision driving this is political. Donald Trump is trying to craft his brand as tough on immigration, and this is pretty tough. Kicking several hundred thousand people out of the country rather unexpectedly, going back to a country that really is not ready to receive them or in any much better shape than when they left, is definitely tough. What's so interesting is that it really contrasts with the spirit of the initial policy that admitted so many Salvadorans over the last couple of decades. The initial motivation was humanitarian in nature. It was to help people who were in desperate need of fleeing a natural disaster. And its continuation under the Bush and Obama administrations continued that spirit of humanitarianism, because they acknowledged that El Salvador was not much a better place than when the folks who had left actually departed.
How does this relate to the fight for dreamers, the so-called dreamers, people that were brought here as children by their parents who are now at risk as well?
Some people who are implicated by this policy change will become dreamers by virtue of having an undocumented status once their temporary protected status expires in 2019. So this cancellation, this suspension of protected status may create a new set of dreamers. It will likely create thousands more undocumented immigrants for those who don't want to return to El Salvador and choose not to. It also will hold an effect on El Salvador itself, because the country has become increasingly reliant on the remittances, the money sent home by many Salvadorans in the United States, much of which is sent home by dreamers and their parents and their families to their families and relatives back in the country of origin.
Is there a big lobby for this to happen with regard to these Salvadorians?
So generally, over the last couple of decades, temporary protected status is the kind of policy that affects a very small number of people very, very acutely, and really is not much of a drain on the United States more broadly. As a result, it really has not been that contentious. There isn't like a big lobby of people saying, you know, we need to end this policy now. There's very little evidence that temporary protected status was a drain on the U.S. economy. Many people would argue that these immigrants' settlement and integration and incorporation to the United States has actually helped the United States, providing labor and a source of taxable income, all of which was legal because they were protected by their status by the United States government. So because of the fact that there wasn't a huge drain on the United States or any kind of public charge, there really wasn't an enormous amount of opposition to temporary protective debt, which is why the Obama administration and the Bush administration was able to issue continuances, was able to extend their protection really uncontroversially previous to now.
The administration's big argument for stricter immigration policy is national security, that our national security is at risk, another reason why he's so adamant about building this wall on the border with Mexico. Do you agree that our national security is in jeopardy due to our current immigration policies?
Current research suggests that immigrants are statistically less likely to commit violent crimes than at the average member of American society. And so it really doesn't make much sense. It just doesn't hold water. And in fact, if you think about the logic behind all of this, it's really quite intuitive that immigrants would not want to commit violent crimes. If you are an immigrant and your status in the United States is conditional on good behavior, then the last thing you want to do is rock the boat and commit the kind of crime that should get you and your family deported. And those incentives have made immigrants integrate into the United States rather peacefully and successfully for generations. And there's no sign that that's changing now.
What kind of response is this getting as far as this decision to send these people back?
I think people are outraged. I think many people who are friends of the Salvadoran community, but also advocates on behalf of immigrants, are outraged by the inhumanity of uprooting people after 17 years in the United States and sending them back to a country that has the highest murder rate in Latin America, that has excruciating poverty, that has rampant gang violence. And the spirit of the policy behind temporary protected status was to house people until it's safe to go home. And I think many people believe that that spirit has been violated by this decision.
All right, Justin Guest, we appreciate your perspective. He's the assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government.
This is Science in a Minute.
Are you someone who performs random acts of kindness for other people? A person walking in front of you drops a bag of groceries and its contents spill out everywhere. you instinctively stoop down and help the other gather up the dropped items. It's just a natural human impulse. New research from Duke University now suggests that we're not the only species that display such altruistic behavior. It turns out bonobos, a group of primates from Africa's Congo Basin, will go out of their way to help strangers without being asked to do so. While studying bonobos who were born in the wild, the researchers found that the small apes will help another get food even when their efforts aren't reciprocated. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, the U.S. Department of the Interior has announced plans to open up 90% of America's coastal waters to oil drilling, including off of California and Florida, two areas where activists have worked for years to protect marine ecosystems from oil spills. The proposed five-year plan released last week is much more expansive than one issued by President Trump in April last year. The Interior Department is proposing 47 possible auctions of drilling rights in nearly all parts of the U.S. continental shelf. The draft plan would allow the sale of drilling leases in 25 of the nation's 26 offshore planning areas, including 19 areas in the waters around Alaska, 7 in the Pacific Ocean, and 9 in the Atlantic. Trump administration has said this will make America an energy leader, but some of his own allies, including the governor of Florida, are pushing back. Joining me now to discuss is Franz Matzner, deputy director of federal campaigns with the Natural Resources Defense Council. What's your reaction to the announcement?
It's not unexpected, considering the broad assault that the Trump administration is launching on all of our public lands and waters, from our national monuments to now our coastal offshore resources that belong to all Americans. This is, though, to say the least, the most radical and sweeping assault on our oceans and all that they support ever from any administration. The proposal as it stands today would threaten to put, you know, oil drill rigs off of our coasts from Maine to Florida and Alaska to California and everything in between. Mm. It's in total disregard of citizens from all across the country, local businesses, residents, governors, members of Congress, Republicans, Democrats. The only voice out there that's celebrating right now are the international oil conglomerates.
Did the Trump administration give a reason for doing this?
So, reasoning, if we want to call it that, is embedded in a, at best, misguided perception that we can drill our way to a safe, healthy, and future, as opposed to what everyone recognizes today, that you can't drill your way there. We have to invest in the next generation of clean energy and not shackle ourselves to a polluting fuel.
Are you guys planning on taking any action, legally or otherwise?
Oh, we will fight this every way we can, starting with working with the countless local partners that we and others have engaged with during the last development of what is now our current five-year plan. I think this is an important part of history. Not only is this just an egregious and shocking sellout of public resources to the private industry, it's a total waste of taxpayer dollars and time. There's a five-year plan in place right now that it was finalized after extensive review and public comment by the previous administration. The impetus to start from scratch and throw that out is an affront to the entire public process that went into that. It's unnecessary, and the only, the only voice it's serving is those who want to fatten the oil industry pocketbooks.
Do you expect a lot of lawsuits with this?
You know, I think it's important that that everyone recognize that while this is barreling forward, it's embattled right out of the gate. This is a proposal. Mm-hmm. It's not finalized yet. There's a public comment period. Citizens have the right to weigh in. Members of Congress, governors, all of our elected officials, I would have an obligation to weigh in. And until it's signed and sealed as final, you know, there's still opportunity to turn the tide. So the first step in avoiding the potential calamity that's on the page here is to stand up and say no.
That's Frank Matzner, deputy director of federal campaigns with the Natural Resources Defense Council. We thank you for your time. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now. This year's Golden Globes Sunday night took a far more serious tone, with stars calling out the torrent of sexual harassment claims engulfing Hollywood. Ryan Brooks reports.
Hollywood's return to the red carpet this year decidedly darker. A fashion blackout dimming the usual glitz and glamour of the Golden Globes as actors take a stand over a sexual misconduct scandal that's shaken the film industry. Big names including Meryl Streep, Angelina Jolie, Emma Stone, and Justin Timberlake dressed in their darkest shades in support of the Time's Up campaign, which has raised millions since last week to fight cases of sexual abuse at work. As the show kicked off, it didn't take long for Globes host Seth Meyers to lay into the likes of Harvey Weinstein, whose empire quickly crumbled under the weight of allegations last year.
But don't worry, he'll be back in 20 years when he becomes the first person ever booed during the In Memoriam. It'll sound like that.
But the moment of the night belonged to Oprah Winfrey, who became the first black woman to receive a Globe's Lifetime Achievement Award, and with trademark gravitas, delivered a stirring speech in support of victims in Hollywood and beyond.
That a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight.
As for the winners, dark drama Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri won big, snapping up four awards. Along with female-driven epics, The Handmaid's Tale and Big Little Lies swept the big-name categories. But few in Hollywood could argue the hashtag MeToo movement was the one to steal the show.
All right. Well, Winfrey's speech immediately touched off speculation Monday that she could be talked into running against President Trump in 2020. Winfrey has never run for public office, but after she brought a cheering crowd of the film industry stars to its feet Sunday night with an inspiring call for a new day in America, her fans immediately voiced their support on social media for a Winfrey presidential campaign against Trump. Well, the Hollywood awards season, as you just heard, got underway Sunday with the Golden Globes. But did you know that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which gives out the awards, also donates millions to charity? VOA's David Byrd tells us how the HFPA is helping bring some joy to children at a Los Angeles hospital.
There aren't any gowns by Versace or shoes by Christian Louboutin at this opening, but there are plenty of smiles. They belong to the children at the Children's Hospital of Orange County because it's movie day. There's popcorn, candy, and even frozen yogurt. And there's a screening of the animated adventure comedy Ferdinand. The screenings are possible because of charitable donations from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to the Lollipop Theater Network, which brings first-run films and other entertainment events to children's hospitals across the country. Layla Ayad works for Lollipop.
We've had a partnership with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association for many, many years. They've funded so much of our movie screenings here, especially in the Los Angeles area. And for a nonprofit, the funding that you get from organizations like HFPA is vital. You don't get to do what you do without people helping fund that.
The HFPA has sponsored 180 Lollipop Theater screenings in Southern California, including the recent showing of Ferdinand at Children's Hospital of Orange County. Patients, their siblings, and their parents are invited to watch the film in the hospital's dedicated theater, and it's complete with snacks. But for those who can't leave their rooms, Leila Ayad says the HFPA has provided DVDs so they, too, can see the film.
They give us several copies of the movie so that we can screen it both in screening rooms and in isolation rooms in other parts of the hospital. And occasionally, they also send along fun goodies and movie swag.
Are you trying to steal my stuff?
Oh, no, we'd never do something like that.
No, not us.
You have offended us, sir.
I'm sorry, little guys. I feel terrible.
Don't fall for it, Ferd. They're filthy weasels.
Amber Chavez is the special programs coordinator at Children's Hospital of Orange County.
You know, it's really hard for families, and just families and patients, siblings, the whole family is affected when the patient is here. And so being able to bring this movie here, like movies out, it just breaks up the environment of the hospital and brings normalcy to them.
The Hollywood Foreign Press Association has given almost $30 million to date, including a $2.8 million grant presented at a star-studded banquet in August of last year. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iranian government's response to the anti-government protests that have swept the country in recent days demonstrates the regime's blatant lack of respect for the fundamental rights of freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. Reports indicate that more than 20 people have been killed, at least 1,000 arrested, and that at times portions of the internet and social media have been blocked. The United States has made clear it stands with the Iranian people's efforts to peacefully articulate their concerns over corruption and aspirations for freedom, as White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders has said. "We support the right of the Iranian people to express themselves peacefully," she wrote. "Their voices deserve to be heard. We encourage all parties to protect this fundamental right to peaceful expression and to avoid any actions that contribute to censorship." On January 4th, for the second time, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert issued a statement declaring U.S. solidarity with the Iranian people. "We continue to monitor closely the protests and violence in Iran," she said. "The Iranian people have been expressing their desire for dignified treatment, an end to corruption, improved transparency, and increased economic opportunities. Unfortunately, the government continues to imprison and kill those who are brave enough to venture into the street. It is limiting the flow of information into Iran, restricting free speech, and attempting to prevent the outside world from observing its own repression." "We support these legitimate aspirations of the Iranian people," she continued, "and call on the government to allow the free exchange of ideas and information. All of us should be able to enjoy the same basic economic and political freedoms, including the right to peaceful demonstration. We condemn in the strongest possible terms the deaths to date and the arrests of at least 1,000 Iranians." Ms. Nauert noted that we have ample authorities to hold accountable those who commit violence against protesters, contribute to censorship, or steal from the people of Iran. Speaking directly to the regime's victims, Ms. Nauert added, "You will not be forgotten."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.